I know we haven't gotten very far yet into our cast of philosophers to be investigated. We said a few things about Hobbes, who isn't that important to this era, but we started with him because chronologically he's in the period we're studying. And then we began to talk about Descartes. And I think, though, that it might be a good idea to review what we've done so far, even though it hasn't been that much, it's been very important. And I'm going to start with a quick review of some of the basic concepts I introduced in the first few talks. One of them is the definition of religious belief, and we'll use my blackboard here. A religious belief is any belief in something as the self-existent origin of all else. If someone believes in more than one of these things, somebody thinks there are two self-existent beings, neither one of them may be the originator of everything else, because they might divide reality up. One might be the origin of these things over here, and the other the different kind of things over there that we find in our created cosmos. But between the two of them, they do account for the origin of everything else. So with that qualification, I think this definition stands up. It stands up to all kinds of scrutiny, including historical scrutiny. If you look at history of religions, and I've read about dozens and dozens of them, and every one has something at the center of their system, which is the self-existent origin of all else. And that is the definition of the divine. And so any belief in that is called, I call, a divinity belief. Now notice that I'm saying that whatever is put in that spot is the divine to people who believe in it. So this definition is independent of any specific description of the divine reality. And I pointed out how this was even recognized in the ancient world. Anaximenes had come up with this before 600 BC. And Aristotle and Plato endorse it. It was common knowledge in the ancient world. They all accepted that the divine was what did not depend on anything. It did not come into being. It did not pass away. And other things depended on it, while it didn't depend on anything. And of course, they had many different descriptions or proposals as to what that was. You remember some of them of the famous earth, air, fire, water, as the uncreated, self-existent stuff that generates everything else. The Pythagoreans said it was numbers. Plato said it was forms and matter. There has to be some stuff, and then there have to be the perfections, the realm of all the truths in math and logic and all the perfections that somehow impresses matter, and so that matter ends up an organized cosmos instead of just a chaos. Many different proposals of what is divine. Some people are surprised to hear that the Pythagoreans put numbers in that category, but they did. In fact, in my first book, I quoted a prayer, a Pythagorean prayer to the number 10. Weird stuff. Okay, but they are searching the cosmos for what it is that is the divine reality that has generated everything else. And that's the way their theories of reality all begin. Theory of reality has a proper name in Greek, and it was the Greeks who invented theory making and philosophy, and its name is ontology. And one big part of philosophy is ontology. What does the thinker say is the nature of reality? After they give us a theory of reality, usually after it, but later thinkers are going to turn this around, they give us a theory of knowledge. And the ancient Greek philosophers did this, so did the medievals, and so did almost everybody in this period we're studying, the modern period. Theory of knowledge has a technical name too, it's epistemology. It's a theory of the nature of the best knowledge we have, of knowledge that's sure and certain. In this period that we're studying, people still did that. They gave an ontology and epistemology. Descartes is going to do that. And so are the people that we're going to study after him, until we come to the last thinker of this period, Immanuel Kant. And Kant's going to turn it upside down, say, no, people have been doing it backward all these centuries. First, you have to get a theory of knowledge. You have to examine the human mind and how it works and get a theory of how it works, what it can know and what it can't, and then see if one of the things it can know is a theory of reality. And his conclusion is, it can't do it. So we can have a theory of knowledge, but we can't get a theory of reality. He calls that metaphysics and dismisses it. It's a dismissive term, as he uses it. So, given this brief review, we have that the divine is whatever a theory or a person regards as the self-existent origin of everything else. And ontologies all started with that. They all, both in the ancient world, the medieval, and the modern period up to Kant, they all start with a theory of reality, and then they give us a theory of knowledge, and then they give us other things that we're going to also look at. For example, they give us a theory of human nature, human society, political philosophy, the theory of the state and the law, and they try to hang it all together on the theory of reality that they give. And we'll see if Kant can really succeed in turning it all upside down. He claims to have come up with the theory of knowledge, and that doesn't need any assumptions about reality in order to be constructed. And I think he fools himself. So we'll see about that when we come to it. Fun and games yet to come, folks. We're going to have a good time. We then took the first period... person to live in this period that we are, the first philosopher to live in this period that we're studying, and that was Thomas Hobbes. And he is unlike any of the philosophers after him or before, because Thomas Hobbes answers the nature of reality by saying it's physical. All reality is purely physical or caused by the purely physical. He's a materialist. In philosophy, being a materialist doesn't mean you're concerned only with the number of possessions you can acquire. It doesn't mean that you're only concerned with how much money you have and how many homes and how many cars and stuff. That's not it. That's a different sort of ethical materialism. We're talking about theory of reality that says reality is essentially physical. And that's what Hobbes held. He held that there are little tiny particles of purely that are purely physical that go into all sorts of combinations and make up everything else. If that sounds roughly like old-timey atomic theory toward the beginning of the 20th century, it is a lot like it. He didn't have as sophisticated an idea of an atom as anyone in the 20th century did, but essentially there are little teeny-weeny physical things, and how they combine determines whether what they combine into is a planet, a tree, an ocean, a horse, or a human. Now, Hobbes didn't want to get into trouble by leaving his theory there. So he added that he believed in God. I don't know whether he said that just to keep himself out of jail or he really meant it. But let's take him at his word. He thinks there's a creator who's not physical, by the way, and who has brought the physical world into existence. So his ontology about creation, about the cosmos in which we live, is that he's a materialist. But his entire position then, if he's sincere about this, his entire position is that everything consists of God or physical objects, physical things. He also thought that math was the way to explain the physical order of the universe. He was as impressed as anybody else with the accomplishments of Kepler and Galileo, Newton, and so on. He was very impressed with all of that. They were applying math to the created world and coming up with explanations that seemed convincing and great improvements over anything anyone had had before them. And it was these successes in astronomy and physics particularly that impressed the heck out of everybody. In fact, in this period, everyone that we're studying was an extraordinary genius. But the most towering genius of the entire period, the one person they all would have pointed to and said, everybody wants to do what this guy did, was Isaac Newton, who didn't write philosophy. He did physics and theology. In fact, he wrote way more theology than he did physics. But he was considered the example, par excellence, of the towering genius who comes to a field that's in complete disarray, figures out some basic laws, comes up with a mathematical formula to apply them to reality, and now all of these disparate things that there seem to be no connection between are all connected and explained by the same basic principles. That is the towering achievement of the age. They all would have told you that. They revered Newton. Hobbes was just as impressed with Newton as anybody else, and he thought that math was the way to go, too. So in what epistemology he did write in Theory of Knowledge, he affirms math as the methodology, but he's not considered a rationalist. So what is a rationalist then? Well, a rationalist isn't somebody who just thinks, okay, there are rational laws, the laws of logic and mathematics. No, a rationalist thinks that determines the basic fabric of reality. Let me see if I can give an illustration that will show this difference. For Hobbes, all our knowledge comes through sense perception. We see, taste, touch, hear, and smell the world around us. That's how we get our information. If we want to organize and explain that, we add mathematical formulae and we try to do it the way Newton and Galileo did. All right? You come to someone like Descartes, and now I'm going to begin the review of what little we covered in him. For Descartes, math and logic, and he viewed them as pretty much the same thing, math and logic give us the fabric of reality. So for a Hobbes, we know the world around us by sense perception. Then we try to organize and explain different things by using math and logic. For Descartes, we know math and logic, and then we try to figure out what the world's like, including perceptions. Descartes is going to raise the issue, can we trust our perceptions? How do we know our perceptions reveal the world as it is outside of us? Perceptions, after all, and this is common to all the people in this period, they all hold this, perceptions are things that occur in here. They occur in brains or in minds. They're inside us. How do we know they show the world the way it is? In fact, how do we know that the perceptions we have are not an internal virtual reality show, and there is no external world at all? How can we trust them? Hobbes assumes you can, and says that's where we get our information, and then we try to organize it with men. Descartes says what we primarily know, what we know for sure, includes the math and logic that the sciences use, but from math and logic alone, we can then say whether perceptions are reliable. And his conclusion is they are. He thinks he can offer us a proof, a logical proof, that perception reliably conveys to us what the external world outside our minds is really like. Not only that, logic can give us a proof that God exists. Logic can give us a proof that the soul, the human soul, is immortal. There are all kinds of things that just from rational principles can be proven to be true and set us off then on a theory of reality and knowledge. Because the theory of reality and knowledge starts with these basic fundamental truths. And that's where we are today. We're going to begin to look at how Descartes tried to bring this off. And of course, I think you know that one of the first things he did was to recommend to us what he called methodological doubt. We're still reviewing now. Covered that a bit last time. Our method then is going to be that we'll approach the whole of human experience and put into the bin doubtful until proven everything that is not deniable. If it can be doubted off, if there's any reason it could be wrong, just simply that we've got no good reason to think it's not, it goes into the bin doubtful. Not that we're really doubting there's an external world or other people and so on. No, he doesn't mean that. That's why he calls it methodological doubt. It fits into the method here of my theory of reality and knowledge. My theory of knowledge is going to start by doubting everything that can be doubted and see what's left. And whatever's left is what we're going to start with. Remember that in my talk with you, when I discussed the century previous to this century, I described it as a century of upheaval and turmoil. That there were three great cultural forces that collided in the 16th century. The established medieval order of the traditional church and state. The Renaissance, trying to revive rationalism from the ancient world. And the Reformation, trying to restore the church and the gospel to what it regarded as its original form. So each one called the other into question. The Renaissance rejected both the traditional church and the Reformation. The Reformation saw what was wrong in the traditional church, in their opinion, and then saw the Renaissance as just the revival of paganism. And out of that conflict, people were left in grave doubt about anything. All of the customs, all of the traditions, all of the sayings that everyone thought were true, everything's being called into doubt by somebody. So Descartes wants to start all over. Let's start by sweeping away everything that could possibly be doubted and ask ourselves, is there anything left? Is there any truth, whatever, that nobody could reasonably doubt, that no one could deny? And when he does that, his answer is, yes, there is one. And I'm writing this in Latin, not because I know Latin, but because it's famous in its Latin form. This is actually taken from St. Augustine, who had written, if I doubt, I must exist. In other words, doubting or thinking by when Descartes says, I think, therefore I am, he means any kind of mental process. If I can think at all about anything, if I'm aware of anything, if I'm conscious of anything, I must exist. I have to exist to be conscious. And then he says that the reason for believing this is that it is, his words again, so clear and distinct so clear and distinct that there is no room for doubt. I think Descartes was on to something when he proposed, I think, therefore I am. Like, that seems to be absolutely right. But not for the reason that it's clear and distinct. I can think of a lot of clear and distinct ideas that do not correspond to realities. A flying carpet. And as just about everybody in philosophy knows, there are great controversies in mathematics about the axioms of math. All of the proposals are clear and distinct, and they cannot all be true. They're in logical conflict with one another. Some are contradictory, some are contrary. It can't all be right, but they're clear and distinct enough. That's how we know they're incompatible with each other. I don't think that the explanation of why the cogito is right is the correct explanation. I think it's simply this, that if you, in order for you to perform any action, whether it's bodily or in your mind, you'd have to exist. And to deny that is what I call self-performatively incoherent. If you have to perform a certain action in order to know X, Y, or Z, then X, Y, or Z can't include that you don't exist. You have to exist to perform the action. That's it. So I think that is certain. But what he does then is take the second part of this, saying that the reason the cogito is right is that it's so clear and distinct that there's no room for doubt. And he uses that to justify other clear and distinct ideas. So the other clear and distinct ideas include logic, and they include mathematics, and they include some axioms about knowledge. One of them, for example, is the principle of sufficient reason. We'll talk about that in just a few minutes. So there are a number of things that he tries to derive from that principles, things being so clear and distinct they can't be wrong. Now, I have a suspicion about what's going on there, and I'll share it with you. The old-timey name for seeing the truth of a statement without any proof is to say it's self-evident. That's the traditional name. If I'm confronted with a proposal and I read that statement, and it looks to me, on the face of it, prima facie, it's true. And it's not derived from any other truth. Then it meets the conditions for being called self-evident. In the ancient world, Aristotle explained that very clearly and asserted that there were many things that were self-evident and we couldn't know them any other way. So self-evidence is a necessary component of knowledge. It's a reliable component of knowledge, but it has restrictions. So having described the experience of self-evidence, to have something appear to you, just look right, look true on the face of it, counts as genuine knowledge. And now Aristotle adds his conditions, if and only if it also is self-evident to all the other experts in this field in which this truth arises. And it had, the truth has to be a law. A law. And if it is self-evident to everyone and it is a law, then it's also infallible. It can't possibly be false. Aristotle added those three things. My point to you is that we all have the experience of seeing things to be self-evidently true. And that's not just the case about statements. Normal sense perception is taken to be self-evident, a self-evident display of the world around us. And everyone regards it as such. From morning to night, every day, everybody, everywhere, regards their perception as showing them the world as it is. It doesn't show them everything about the world. It doesn't show them the subatomic level, but it shows us the surface level of the world as it is. That everybody thinks that, until they're given some clever philosophical argument that tries to convince them that that's not reliable. Now, Descartes didn't give us yet a clever philosophical argument that perception can't be trusted, but he did go into the bin of things that are doubtful until proven. Later on, he did give some arguments. He pointed to hallucinations. He pointed to realistic dreams. He said, at times I've had a dream that I didn't know was a dream until I woke up. But while I was dreaming, that was not reality, but I was perceiving an illusion. He gives those as reasons why perception can't just be declared reliable, because there are unreliable perceptions. So he sets off on the project of proving that except for hallucinations and realistic dreams, perception is reliable. We would add today holograms, I guess. They also can deceive us. But he didn't know about them. So he wants to say what it is that goes into this class of sure and certain reliable beliefs that are so clear and distinct there's no room for doubt. What else can go in there that is enough like the cogito ergo sum that they can be counted to? And he's going to say the principles of mathematics, logic, and some other axioms he's going to propose. And then he's allowed to use them too, say. That's his procedure. All of them come up unscathed when you try to doubt them. There's no reasonable way to doubt them at all. The fundamental axiom of logic is the principle of non-contradiction. Consider the non-contradiction and see if there's a way to doubt it. It says no statement can be true and false at the same time in the same sense. So if I borrowed $20 from you and I haven't paid you back, I can't say, well, it's just as true that I did pay you back. No, I either paid you back or I didn't, but it can't be both. And it can't be neither. Either I paid the debt or I didn't. And you would never let me get away with saying, well, it's just as true that I did as that I didn't, so I'm not going to pay you. You'd say, yes, you are, because you owe me. Okay. That's one example of something that can't be doubted, the law of non-contradiction. There are people that try to do it, but they employ it while denying it. Same thing is true about some basic mathematical truths, and some, I call them other axioms, and we're going to talk about them as well. Okay, this is the point at which, if I were in your classroom, I would now say, what questions do you have? I can't do that. So I have to assume that the review has helped. It sets some things in greater clarity, and now we're going to go ahead with Descartes, who is proposed to offer to us a proof that normal sense perception is reliable and shows us the world the way it is. you took on that task, how would you try to, how would you go about it? Well, here's how Descartes went about it. Here's his argument. I'm going to let you see it as I write it. Premise one of the argument, the principle of sufficient reason, that's what PSR stands for. The principle of sufficient reason says, for everything, there must be a cause or explanation. Now think about that for a minute. It's not something you never think of on your own, right? You just assume that. For everything there must be a cause explanation. Except that you assume, all of us would naturally assume, that everything in fact has a cause or explanation. That's not what this says. It doesn't merely say that everything that's real in fact has a cause or explanation. It says must have a cause or explanation. So if I make a proposal in a theory, and for some it's worded so strangely that it can't have a cause or explanation, then anybody subscribing to the principle of sufficient reason would say, I deny that, throw that out. That has no cause or explanation. You can't have part in the theory. Aristotle didn't balk at this one. I started to tell you that he made three extra conditions that had to apply to anything as to be genuinely self-evident. Even he thought this survived. He thought everybody would concede that it's true. Everybody who is knowledgeable enough in these issues to have an opinion, he thought that it's a law, it's a rule, and that it's therefore infallible. But Descartes didn't say about these truths that are so like the cogito that they count, he didn't call himself evident. Because he didn't want to run afoul of Aristotle's three restrictions. In fact, Descartes liked the three restrictions. He endorsed them and he made them worse. For him, the first restriction wasn't that it has to appear self-evident to everyone who's knowledgeable in this field. He said it would have to appear self-evident to anyone who is in the least degree rational. So if you're not demented, you're not nuts, you're going to see this. Then he agreed it had to be a law and it produced infallibility. You understand what that does? That one of the things that does is that it rules out normal sense perception. Sense perceptions are not laws. They're things like tables and chairs and walls and chairs people sit in. Or there are perceptions, Descartes would want to say, perceptions are copies of them in our minds. But they're not laws. So they can't be self-evident. Can't be self-evidently real. I think that's a huge mistake, but we'll talk about that as we go. I'll try to explain why. So, the first thing for him is the principle of sufficient reason. For everything, there must be a cause or explanation. And if you ask him how he comes to that conclusion, what gives him the right to say that that's true, then Descartes is going to say that this is an axiom that is so clear and distinct it can't be false. Or, as it would have been put before him, it's self-evident. So that's the first step of his proof. Second step of his proof, causes are always equal to or greater than their effects. Okay, what's the reason for thinking that's right? Well, it's the principle of sufficient reason. If I have a cause of something, suppose I have hooked up an apparatus to a flowing stream and it turns a paddle wheel and that pumps water and I collect the water. The cause here, the mechanism of the paddle wheel, can't produce more water than you put into it. Why not? Because if there's more than what the cause can give an account of, that more doesn't have any cause or explanation. So premise two of his argument about causation assumes premise one. That's not common in a logical argument, and certainly not a requirement. The premises don't follow from one another. The premises are together the reasons for believing the conclusion of the argument. But here he gives an argument that starts with an axiom, and then he gives a second premise to the argument, and the defense of it is the first premise. Causes are equal to their effects, or greater than their effects, but the effects can't be greater than the cause. There can't be more results of an action. There can't be, say, more energy produced than went into it. Otherwise, it would have no cause or explanation. Premise three. There exists in my mind an idea of infinity. There exists in my mind an idea of infinity. Now, let's get this as clear as we can, as fast as we can. There is such a thing as quantitative infinity. The natural number series, for example, is quantitatively infinite. There's no last number, because to any number you could always say plus one more. That's quantitatively unending, infinite. That's not what Descartes means here. He means qualitatively infinite. Well, what is that? Qualitatively infinite means something, I'm going to write it down and then erase it. Something is qualitatively infinite when it has all and only perfections. Now this is the proposal that goes all the way back to Plato. Plato argued that for everything that we see in this world, there's a perfect instance of that in another world, in another realm, that we can't see with our eyes. We can't perceive this other realm. But in the other realm is the perfect what it is to be a horse. And what there are in the world in which we live are imperfect copies of the perfect horse. And that's how things in this world get to be trees, mountains, clouds, humans, everything here. We have a multiplicity of imperfect copies of the perfection in another world. Descartes doesn't necessarily subscribe to the other world. You know, Plato's great barnyard in the sky with all the perfections, but he does think that there are such things as perfections. There's the highest possible good, the highest possible justice, the highest possible mercy, the highest possible degree of knowledge, of power, and so on and on and on. Now notice he doesn't have to figure out all of the perfections that are real. Here's a definition that says, a being is an infinite being, as I am using the term infinite, he's saying to you, when it has only perfections as its characteristics. It has them all, whatever they are. We may never figure them all out, but whatever they are, an infinite being has them all and has only perfections. That's what I mean by an infinite being. I have that idea in my mind, he says. Now, how can you doubt that when he just told you what the idea means? He has the idea, all right. All and only perfections. Of course, he's not trying to kid anybody. He knows that theologians before him used that expression of God. They said the only being with all and only perfections was God. So that's what he's doing here. He's saying, I have in my mind an idea of infinity. Okay. And his conclusion is, therefore, you ready for this? Therefore, there exists an infinite cause of my idea. Of infinity. Wow. He elaborates on that a bit more. He says, this idea of infinity that I have, it can't be derived from perception. None of us ever perceives any perfection. There are no perfections. Nothing in this world is perfect. Right? Even in geometry, when you draw a line or a circle, they're not perfect figures. We say that what we draw represents a perfect figure, but if you look at it up close under a magnifying glass, it's all irregular and it's not perfect. There are no perfections in this world, but we still have an idea of perfection, of a perfect line, a perfect triangle. But look at the principle of causality. The principle of causality, it's the premise of his argument, says causes can be equal to their effects or greater than them, but the effect can't be greater than the cause. Now, the idea in my mind is the effect of something. It's not the effect of perception, of looking around the world. There are no perfections. And could it be that it's just my mind has the power to think of perceptions when it sees all things in the world, says, well, maybe there's a perfect what it is to be a horse or a human or a triangle. But, he says, in that case, my mind would have to be infinite to be the cause of something infinite. Right? Causes can't be greater than their effects. But I know for a fact my mind's not infinite. I know by introspection that my mind doesn't possess all perfections. It's not all powerful, all loving, all good, all kind, all knowing. No, my mind is very finite and limited. And in addition to some nobler thoughts, it often has ones that are pretty raunchy and that I wouldn't want other people to know about. So my mind is not infinitely perfect and can't be the cause of an infinitely perfect idea. And here you have Descartes, one of the three arguments Descartes gave, proving the existence of God. So let's summarize that again, see how that goes. One, the principle of sufficient reason. Two, the principle of causality. And that means effects can't be greater than their causes. Three, there exists in my mind an idea of infinity, which means qualitative infinity. It means there exists in my mind an idea of something having all and only perfections. Therefore, there exists an infinite cause of my idea of infinity. If I have this idea, it has to have a cause. According to premise one, there has to have a cause or explanation. According to premise two, whatever is the cause of it can't be less than it. And the it is infinite. Therefore, the cause has to be infinite. So there is an infinite being. There is a being with all and only perfections. And to quote Thomas Aquinas, et hoc dicimus est Deus. And this we say is God. Okay, this is part one. Part one of Descartes' proof. Now he launches into part two. We're going to assume that everybody knows that the usual name for the infinite being is God. Premise five. God cannot deceive us. What's the reason for that? Well, God can't deceive us because the only things that are true of God are perfections. He has them all. So he has infinite honesty. Follows from the definition of God. He's a being with all and only perfections, then he can't deceive us. Okay. Then, his next premise, I'm going to approximate, give you in my own words. If normal sense perception did not show us the world, and by this he means the external world, as it is, God would be a great deceiver. But since God can't deceive us, it follows that normal sense perception conveys to us the world as it is. I'll bet that when I said to you that Descartes is going to prove that sense perceptions are reliable, and I asked you how you would do it if you're going to try that, you never thought of anything like this. But that's how he tackled it. First, he can prove the existence of God based on principles that are self-evidently true, or are, in his terms, so clear and distinct that they can't be false. The principle of sufficient reason, the principle of causality. Apply them to my idea of God, and it follows that the only thing that could have caused that idea is the being with all and only perfections. Can't be caused by my mind, because it doesn't have all and only perfections. It can't be caused by my perceiving the world around me, because that world doesn't have any perfections. It had to have been produced in me by a being that has all and only perfections. Therefore, there is such a being. And since one of the perfections is infinite honesty, that being can't be the great deceiver. That being can't be a being that puts into everybody's mind perceptions of the world and the innate inclination to regard those perceptions as reliable, and make those perceptions unreliable. Right? There's two things that go on in us. We perceive the world, but everybody just naturally assumes that that is reliable information about the world around them. Now, if I live in India, and I open the front door and I see a snake crawling toward my front door, I take it as veridical, I slam the door. Now, in my neighborhood where I live in New Jersey, if I saw a big snake, I might think it was a joke or a trick or a hologram, because I know enough about the area I live in to know that no such beasts live there. That's all. It's not that we can never make a mistake about a perception. It's the perceptions themselves don't misrepresent the world that they convey to us. And Descartes thinks he's got that locked up. There it is again. For everything, there has to be a cause or explanation. And the cause or explanation has to be greater than the effect. The effect can't be greater than its cause. There exists in my mind an idea of infinity. That has to have a cause then. And the cause can't be less than the effect. The effect's the idea of infinity. Well, then the cause has to be infinite. And then the second part is, therefore God can't deceive us because he has infinite honesty. And if normal sense perception didn't show us the external world the way it is, God would be a great deceiver. But God can't be a great deceiver, so it's not true that normal sense perception doesn't show us the way the world is. Therefore, conclusion. These three dots you may remember from geometry. Logic means, therefore, normal sense perception conveys to us the world as it is. And now Descartes is off to the races, because now we can trust our perception, we can know that God is real, and we can trust God, and now we can scientifically investigate the world around us. Although, in fact, Descartes himself wasn't all that interested in the world around us. He was interested in the math and the logic, the axioms of which can't be false. And as you know, probably, Descartes invented analytic geometry, which was what made him famous. What did him in was that he was hired by the Queen of Sweden to go up there to Sweden to be her tutor. And I mentioned to you how he liked to lie in bed till noon every day and do his work, writing and research, in bed. He'd stack the books and stuff and he'd write. But he never got up before noon, and then he had a very active nightlife, going to parties and such. Well, she invited him up to Sweden to be her tutor, and he said no a couple of times, but then finally he fell on economic hard times, and he thought that her pay was pretty good, and so he'd go do it for a while. So he went up to Sweden, where the winters were a lot longer and the weather a lot colder, and she expected her lessons with him to begin at 5 a.m. every morning. And under those conditions, he didn't last very long. He wrote for her a little work that we still read called Meditations on First Philosophy. It's a little book, and he goes through point by point, makes these arguments. He was trying to instruct her, but between lack of sleep and the cold weather and so on, he caught pneumonia and died. He was only 55. So the first of the really powerful thinkers to leave a very influential set of books and works is Descartes, and he doesn't live very long, and he doesn't live to see the controversies about his work or some of the criticisms of it. I think that's what we should launch into now. Let's discuss this proof and Descartes' position here. Taking each premise one at a time. The principle of sufficient reason I don't have any quarrel with, but that's mainly because I believe in God, so everything does have cause or explanation. It's the will of God. But in this argument, no one could say that, because he tries to use it to prove the existence of God. So if his reason for holding the principle of sufficient reason is that God is the creator of everything, and nothing happens against his will, then this whole argument is circular. It assumes the principle of sufficient reason, assumes belief in God, and then he tries to prove belief in God is true. But that's to argue in a circle. In logic, that's called the fallacy of begging the question. So that would not be allowed to him as a reason. I think what he tried to do is defend the principle of sufficient reason as a clear and distinct axiom. And, giving him credit as a decent logician, we'd have to say the same thing about the second premise, that causes don't produce more than the reality they have to work with. Seems absolutely right, doesn't it? Otherwise we could get a perpetual motion machine. We could set some machine up and we feed into it so many volts and watts of electricity and it produces more than that, so it keeps itself going, and plus there's something left over to heat our house. Well, we could all wish, but nothing works like that. How does Descartes know that that's a necessary truth, that it's a law? He doesn't tell us, but he puts it down as, again, an axiom. And I think in the end, that's how he'd have to defend this. He'd have to say that premise two is also a clear and distinct I have trouble with this pen, but a clear and distinct idea, so it counts as an axiom. Premise three, there's no problem with. If he said he had an idea of something infinite and couldn't tell us what he meant by that, there would be a problem. But he was very clear, and there was a long tradition of among theologians of calling God the being with all perfections and only perfections. So he knew that his readers would understand that. And he certainly had the idea. And then he goes on to draw out consequences of the first part of the proof for the second part. God can't deceive us because he's infinitely honest. If normal sense perception didn't show us the world as it is, God would be a great deceiver. Why? Because God made us so that we just naturally take normal sense perception to be showing the world as it is. So the fact that we have these perceptions and the fact that we naturally have the inclination to trust them to show us the world is due to the fact, due to the way God has made us. So if he made us to believe that a deception was the truth, he would be a great deceiver. He can't be a great deceiver, so he didn't make perception deceptive. It shows us the way the world is. So what do you think of this proof? Do you find this convincing? I'd love to hear your reasons. I'm going to tell you why I don't find it convincing. He uses the expression idea of infinity twice in the argument. First, he says it exists in his mind. Then in the conclusion of that proof, he says about idea of infinity, it must have an infinite cause. Okay? So he means first an idea in his mind, and secondly, he claims that that idea itself needs an infinite cause. Now this is a logical fallacy that goes by the name equivocation. It means you use the same term or expression more than once, and you don't mean the same thing by it when it occurs the first time from when it occurs the second. It has different meanings. Look at it again. For Descartes, what exists in his mind is an idea. Okay? No quarrel. He can have the idea. But why would the idea of infinity need an infinite cause? The idea isn't infinite, it's the idea of infinity. The idea of infinity is a finite part of this world, like everything else. His idea isn't infinite. His idea doesn't have every perfection. It's not that he has an idea in his mind that has all power, all knowledge, all goodness, all justice, all... No, his idea doesn't have them. It's the idea that something might have them. So his idea doesn't require an infinite cause. His idea is infinite. He had the idea of something being infinite. Ain't the same animal. So his proof fails. If you want to know what Descartes said to this, the answer is, I can't tell you because he died before people made this criticism. I think what he'd say is, I withdraw that and go to my other two proofs. I don't think he'd give up, but I think he'd take this one back. And this is the main one that he defends in that little book I referred to, the Meditations on First Philosophy. His other arguments are equally faulty, I'm sorry to say. They do not prove the existence of God. Well, I take that back. I'm not sorry to say it. I'm pleased to say it, because I already mentioned to you once my opinion about proofs of the existence of God. Since our scripture tells us that God created everything, visible or not, they are clearly trying to say that he created everything whatsoever that is in creation and in heaven, everything other than himself. God has created everything. All things, principalities, powers, dominions, all things visible and invisible. No exceptions. In that case, he created the laws of logic and the laws of mathematics.
He created the laws by which we construct proofs. Trying to prove God, then, is lowering him to being a creature subject to those laws. He's not. He's the creator of the laws. They don't apply to him. Unless he willingly takes them on. And of course, that's what we think happened. We think that because that's the gospel message of the New Testament. God takes, created Jesus Christ into himself. So that God is the divine side of Jesus and Jesus is the human side of God. If God can take one creaturely thing into himself, he can take others. And that's how I view God's revelation of himself even prior to Jesus. He had taken characteristics into himself. Not from the world, but maybe he created them in himself first and then imparted them to creatures. Or maybe he did it simultaneously. But God really had the characteristics of being all-powerful with respect to every power in the world. He really had the characteristic of being all-loving toward his creatures, even when they rebel against him. And he makes covenant after covenant to rescue them. But those are created characteristics that we can understand, to which our logic applies, which are contained in our language, and so on. But they're still true of the uncreated creator because he took them into himself. Just as he later took the whole person of Jesus Christ, who reveals the whole character of God. He's the image of the invisible God. So when somebody constructs a proof of the existence of God, they mean well. They mean it to be a compliment. They mean it to aid others in seeing that that's the truth and why it is. But that can't work. And it oughtn't to be done. Now next time we'll meet and we'll talk further about René Descartes and the system that he cooked up based on these fundamental truths. Please do your reading and think about it.